From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
But more often than not, it's not just ketamine. It might be alcohol and ketamine, which can be quite dangerous in combination.
So they could be drunk and then they're giving ketamine a go.
Yes.
So, you know, from Vladimir Putin's perspective, this is the best US president he's ever going to get.
Did he show any contrition in his gorgeous little puppy eyes?
Coming up on this Grey Skies edition of Playback Daily, PsyCare, the charity helping festival goers in trouble. When presidents East and West are on the same page, and the daring escapades of one Liveline listener's dog. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that doesn't need a dog for daring escapades. Let's get started with Oliver Callan, who began his morning monologue by talking about that terrible incident at the parade for Premier League champions Liverpool yesterday evening.
There's an extraordinary article in the Telegraph this morning, which I think kind of covers the whole thing. The car sped through Water Street, one of the city's main roads leading down towards the riverfront, for 200 yards before it came to a halt. Witnesses spoke of their horror in the aftermath. It was around 6 o'clock yesterday evening, maybe while you were having your dinner, and one paramedic was overheard telling police the Royal Liverpool Hospital was overwhelmed with casualties very quickly because the emergency services responded so quickly and efficiently. One witness described the sickening pop, pop, pop of victims being thrown across the car's bonnet. Another said she felt like a sardine packed into the street, and we heard beeping and screaming and a people carrier driving straight towards us. The incident happened towards the end of the Liverpool team's trophy parade. It went through the city centre and it was meant to be a day of joy and celebration after winning the Premier League title and doing so in the first time outside of lockdowns, because it was 2020 the last time. But of course, for this city and this club, the scenes echo the deaths at Hillsborough when Liverpool fans were crushed in 1989 at the FA Cup semi-final. Incredibly, incredibly, nobody was killed last night. The police then issued a statement saying, "We can confirm the man arrested is a 53-year-old white British man from the Liverpool area. Extensive inquiries are ongoing," and they obviously asked people not to speculate on the circumstances surrounding the incident, because straight away nefarious elements were online claiming, blaming it on immigration and whatnot, the usual thing that happens when dreadful incidents like this occur. Video footage of the crash showed the car was moving slowly, but as crowds protested against this car moving slowly, the driver reversed, and I believe it was into an ambulance, heard a report on Morning Ireland this morning, and then beeped his horn, put his foot to the accelerator and drove through the crowd at speed, and there was nothing between the car and the crowd. One witness says, "I think what happened is he was trying to get down the streets and clip somebody. The crowd reacted and were trying to open the driver's door and the passenger door. I think he panicked and put his foot right down and just ploughed through the crowd. The driver was panicking. I could see he put his foot down as far as it would go. I've never seen anything like it. People were shouting. Kids were crying. It was an awful scene." Another witness just said, "It was terrifying. People were moving out of the way. He put his foot to the floor. He just went straight through." A witness, Harry Rashid, said the car appeared to have a baby seat in the back, but it was apparently empty apart from the driver. Stalled for a few seconds, and as the crowd tried to prevent him, causing more destruction, the driver accelerated again. It was horrible. You could hear the bumps as he was going over the people. It's extraordinary nobody was killed. However, anyone injured could have injuries that are going to affect them for the rest of their lives. Four children are among the injured in hospital, and many children, of course, witnessed this traumatic moment and would no doubt be affected as well, which is just extraordinary, extraordinary moment, and not what they were hoping to be reporting this morning after that Liverpool celebration.
Indeed not. And as Oliver noted, a miracle that no one was killed. Meanwhile, the President of France is trying to mansplain his way out of a slightly embarrassing video that's doing the rounds. "But that's just the way some people play," is what he's saying. Do we believe him? Oliver has the audio equivalent of a raised eyebrow about it.
Now, Emmanuel Macron and his wife are also across all the news sites on TikTok videos and so on because of what looked like a domestic incident. Well, the French president has denied that he and his wife Brigitte had an altercation. The viral video is being promoted by Russian state media and the far right in France, of course. What it shows, what it appears to show her, well, it shows her pushing him in the face as they're preparing to get off a plane in Vietnam. Her body's not in shot. You see a hand as Macron prepares to come down the stairs and forcefully pushes him in the face. He steps back a bit. He looks pretty annoyed about it. And then he recovers very quickly and does a sort of a slightly embarrassing wave as a kind of, everything's okay here. And as they come down the stairs anyway together and they look fine. French officials initially rejected the video and said, this is probably fake news. But then, of course, when it was verified, the presidential aides for Mr. Macron said the half-glimpsed gesture was part of the normal chamaillerie. Oh, no, I made an absolute dog's dinner of that. But playful horsing around in French is what it means. It was a moment when the president and his wife were unwinding one last time before the start of the trip by having a laugh. It's a moment of complicity, strange word, or maybe a mistranslation. It was all it took to give conspiracy theorists more fodder, and the Russian media are talking about that it was a slap. Macron himself told reporters as he landed in Vietnam that himself and his wife were just joking around. We do this quite often. And the Elysee Palace has said the scene showed a moment of closeness, and this set off the conspiracy theorists. The couple were decompressing one last time before the start of the visit, larking about. Mr. Macron loves playing jokes like on his wife before official occasions, and she always responds like this. It wasn't a slap. It's more of a kind of a shove in the face rather than a slap. But he did look embarrassed by it. And Macron has also noted that other videos of him recently have been misinterpreted. People thought I shared a bag of cocaine recently on a train. And he's referring to the train journey he took with the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz and Keir Starmer. And the US conspiracy theorist says, look at these idiots taking drugs, because there's a little white thing on the table. And Macron snatches away and puts it away in his pocket. But close-ups reveal it was a crumpled tissue, not a bag of cocaine. And they laughed it off in the Elysee Palace, as they're trying to laugh this off now as well.
Dare we say sacré bleu? From one political brave face to another sort of political vanished face, have you noticed how Elon Musk has stopped being in the media every second of every day? Oliver has.
The article in The Guardian, which one of the most read things at the moment, whatever happened to Elon Musk? Remember him? The tech boss has drifted to the margins of Trump world. This has started in Politico, who've been analysing Trump's references to Elon Musk and kind of going, what's happened to Elon Musk? He totally disappeared from the spotlight. It did feel like we're talking about him every single day for the first two, possibly 3 months of the Trump administration, 2.0. Politico found a sharp drop in the number of times that Trump has posted about Musk on his own social media platform. 4 times a week at one stage in February, almost every day, and then to zero since the start of April. I think he's only posted about him once in the past 2 months. In February, Trump's fundraising operation invoked Musk in his fundraising emails every single day. One message read, I love Elon Musk. But such mentions stopped in early March, with the exception of one email in May since. And the White House officials, they no longer fill their social media feeds with Musk-related content. Reporters don't ask questions about him at the White House press briefing. Members of Congress are giving his name a wide berth, including the Republican ones. And Elon Musk seems to be taking the hint, because the Tesla chief executive has reduced his role as of this week. This was the end of May. It's a very quiet quasi-exit. He's going to work in DOGE, which is the Department of Government Agency that isn't a department. 2 days a week he's going to do there. And he also announced that he's going to cut his political spending. He spent $250 million on Trump's campaign. But this is the thanks he's getting. He's out in the cold now for sure. And it seems that it's to do with poll numbers. The polls have killed off his use to the administration. 60% of those polled roughly have an unfavourable view of Trump. And that includes Republicans upset with the number of people being laid off in federal departments and the effect it's had. A Democratic member of Congress who knows Elon Musk for years, Ro Khanna, as his numbers declined, so did Trump's interests, they say. Trump discards people when their ratings fall. It's very transactional. His cuts in DOGE have failed. He promised $2 trillion worth of cuts. It's about $81 billion in reality, but a lot of that has led to inefficiencies. And of course, the US aid has almost collapsed, and all the soft power for the Americans with it, and into the gap have gone the Chinese, particularly into Southeast Asia. He's learned the lesson a lot of very successful business leaders learn, that democracy is much tougher than they imagine and doesn't bend to their will. And Tesla is in trouble as well. In the business news there this morning, electric car sales are up 29% in Europe in the month of April, but sales of Tesla have fallen by 49% compared to a year ago, which is just extraordinary. The brand is in the toilet because Elon Musk has needled people in Britain and across Europe. He's expressed support for the far right anti-immigration AfD in Deutschland. That's gone down very badly. So it's gone. The experiment hasn't worked. and a political science professor, Brown University, they're one of the universities under attack from the Trump administration, says there is nobody you can sincerely believe Donald Trump thinks is important to his popularity or his standing in a positive way, because he believes he generates all the good stuff for him himself. So I don't think he's wrong about that as well. He says if you become a liability, as Elon Musk has become, you're gone pretty quickly. So out he goes.
And it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. A slightly smaller audience to practice his Roman salutes to. But wait, what's this about Nicola Coughlan?
She's online posting about something which will make a lot of people jealous, particularly in the west of Ireland. Nicola is a true Galway person. She has posted a special gold card. We know about the famous nightclub gold card, but she's been gifted a Supermax gold card, and it has an expiry of never. It's a lifetime gold card. It's called a Super VIP gold card, and apparently gives her a Supermax lunch for free for life. And she's always made her love of the of Galway's local cuisine known. Shouts about her love for it on the set of Bridgerton, and on Chicken Shop Dinner, which is something that exists. Loads of podcasts. And it's a very nice card. It's a literally gold-coloured card. Nicola Coughlan's name is there and the title Super VIP above it. And her other pseudonyms, Claire Devlin, which is her character in Derry Girls, of course, and Lady Whistledown, which I think is her character in Bridgerton. And in case she pops in for an old chicken breast sandwich between things that she does and her A-list level celebrity. And I'm sure there are there other Galwegians. Is there a list somewhere of the Super VIP, Supermax gold card holders? I'm not sure. It's kind of a club. Maybe she's broken all the rules already. Who knows?
Yeah, but what if she brings in some friends to Supermax? Can she get their meals on her card? Or do they have to spend their own money? I think we should be told. But not right now, because we've reached the end of our excerpt from the Oliver Callan morning monologue for another day. Ah, mon visage! On Today with Clare Byrne this morning, Clare brought in Peter Chap Clear, Fianna Fáil TD for Carlow Kilkenny, and Claire Curran, Sinn Féin spokesperson for children, to talk about the cost of childcare, which, according to the programme for government, should be coming down to a maximum of €200 per child per month.
From the government's perspective, we're absolutely committed that Ireland is a great place to raise a family. And since 2020, since Fianna Fáil was in government, investment in the childcare sector has doubled to over €1 billion. It's the most funding ever since the foundation of the state going into the childcare sector. Yes, there are challenges out there and more needs to be done, but there's three core objectives of this government to get childcare to where it needs to be, and they're under the realms of affordability, accessibility and quality. And on affordability, it's a very, very specific measure in the programme for government that we're going to work towards reducing the cost of childcare to €200 per child, and if there are additional members of a family, that would put a cap on larger families.
But it says more than just work towards. I mean, the programme for government promises that the cost of childcare will be €200 per month per child. So what's happening now?
It's a very, very specific measure, but obviously there's a budgetary process we need to go, and it needs to be done over the lifetime of the government. The last government, obviously, when core funding would have brought in, would have been delivery of fee freezes and increased sustainability and increased wages for staff. But in addition to that, Claire, there's a lot of universal funding has happened as well, such as the parental leave extended to 9 weeks, additional child benefit payments. We've got the GP visit cards under eight, free school books, free school meals. So there's a lot
which
of measures outside.
Which is all great,
of,
and people will welcome that. Yeah. But when is the childcare going to be €200 a month? Or what's happening, say, in 2025 to try and reach that aim?
So there is a very specific measure in the programme for government to say that childcare will reduce to €200 per month over the lifetime of this government. Obviously, negotiations are ongoing. We're in the programme for government. We're in the budgetary process now. And the first steps on that will start to take shape in this budget. But it's to be done over the lifetime of this government.
You've a long way to go, though, because it's, you know, people are paying upwards of €800 a month per child in some places. To get that to 200 is a big cost factor for this government, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the government has a very ambitious programme on it. But I suppose I would have been councillor for 10 years previously in Kilkenny, Clare, and I suppose a TD for the last 6 months. And I suppose when you're meeting people and you're talking to families on the doorstep, it does come up. Childcare is an issue. I have four children myself, ranging from 10 to 16 years of age. I've been through it. I left my house at 6 o'clock this morning, and my mother-in-law actually came up and minded their children because my wife was working as well. So everybody's circumstances are different. Everybody's family makeup is different. And I suppose what we want to do over the next 5 years as a government is to make sure that whatever the choice is of the family, whether that be the childcare setting or a child minding, that the supports are there to help families. We need to make sure that the families are helped and that access to excellent childcare
right.
is there.
Okay, but what I'm not getting from you is what's happening right now, this year. What will people see in this budget in terms of bringing the bill down from €800 or more yeah. per child closer to the 200?
Yeah, well, I suppose Minister Foley specifically said that in the programme for government as well that there's an action plan being developed to set out the important next steps for the next phase of transformation of this essential service. So work is ongoing behind the scenes. I mean, this government is only in operation a little over 100 days at this stage, so we're in its infancy stages. But I can assure you, and I can assure your listeners, and I can assure families out there that are struggling in terms of not just affordability but also accessibility as well.
Yeah.
There is an awful lot has been done, but there's a lot more to do in this space as well.
Okay, well, Claire, you're listening to all that. Are you reassured that something wonderful is going to happen now, probably around October time?
No, is the short answer. We are seeing no detail at all from this government in terms of commitments made in the programme for government. I, in conjunction with the National Women's Council and their 43 strong organisations that have made up now the Public Alliance, brought forward a motion to the Dáil 3 weeks ago. It wasn't looking for anything extra. It was looking for detail in terms of that broad consultation and detailed action plan, a detailed action plan that Simon Harris said will be produced within the first 100 days of government. We have not seen that. And the minister could not provide us with detail when we debated that motion that evening. We have no details on the terms of reference for the broad consultation, when it will take place, which would really tell me that means obviously no detailed action plan. And we're not going to see that before the budget. Mm-hmm. So there is great frustration because during this cost of living crisis, childcare is really expensive. It's well in excess of €800 for some families, particularly in Dublin and other bigger cities. And the problem is we don't have the detail from government. Simon Harris went on social media on Facebook a couple of weeks ago asking people to share their experiences. Why don't they just get on with the broad consultation and get it done?
Maybe that is the consultation, is it?
No, it is. Well, I would hope it isn't, Claire. You know, it's a commitment in the programme for government. That's why we want to see the terms of reference and a time frame mm-hmm. for this broad consultation. A video on social media, I hope, is not the broad consultation.
Right.
It wouldn't want to be.
So, Peter, you've no action plan and no details on the consultation. It really doesn't bode well for what we might see in October, does it?
No, I actually do agree with Claire. It is a specific recommendation in the programme for government that reduction in fees paid by parents will go to €200 per month over its lifetime. That is a very specific measure. Mm. It's probably the most specific measure in the whole programme for
yeah,
government.
What we're trying to get at, though, is what you're doing to get there. And so, it would seem nothing apart from Simon Harris doing the videos on Facebook.
No, I'd refute that. There's an action plan going to be set up to build an affordable, high quality, accessible early education and care system with state-led facilities adding capacity. So with the scope of the action plan, we need to design a comprehensive stakeholder consultation.
Where is the action plan?
It's in the, as I said to you, Claire, the government is only up and running 100 days.
Yeah, but you
at
said,
stage.
But what Claire
there's
says is the action plan was promised in the first 100 days. There's no sign of it. There's no sign even of the consultation process and how that might work.
Huge work is done behind the scenes with the department officials. Minister Norman Foley has engaged with stakeholders, as we do with the core funding model. Every single 12 months, mm-hmm. we sit down to see what's working, what's not working, what needs to be done differently, where funding can be increased. And Claire will confirm this. Over €1 billion is invested in the childcare sector over the last 12 months. The highest ever. So government recognises...
You don't dispute
that,
Claire,
Grand,
do you? That investment has gone in?
Well, just to say, the Public Alliance, which is 43 strong organisations, have looked to meet the minister and that meeting hasn't taken place. They'd be the very first group I'd be looking to in terms of broad consultation. But on the money, that's absolutely correct. It's about €1.3 billion. Mm. But then that begs the question also, Claire. Like, if we're putting €1.3 billion into the childcare and early years sector, why are so many parents still paying well in excess of €1,000? And that is why the review that's committed to in the programme for government of core funding is also really important. I'd like to see a lot more transparency in relation to that €1.3 billion, where it's going and what that impact is having on parents and on the workforce, the educators in particular who are leaving
yeah.
in their droves.
Just going back to the election campaign, your party, Sinn Féin, promised €10 a day per child attending somewhere like a creche, so a centre-based childcare. And you said you'd be able to do that by September of this year and it would cost €345 million. So how would you meet that timeline? How is it done?
So we're very fortunate in that the mechanism already exists through the National Childcare Scheme, and we're talking about investing more into that so we close the gap between what a parent pays to get them to €200 a month, €10 a day. We got it costed by the Parliamentary Budget Office. Now, of course, we don't have the same data, nor did they, in terms of what the department would have, but we were given a cost of €345 million to bring it to €10, and that is to include childminders as well, because there's a major gap in terms of childminders, which is having an impact on choice for parents and capacity as well. So that's the figure we were given from the Parliamentary Budget Office, and it can be done by September. And the only reason it can be done by September is because the system is already there in terms of the National Childcare Scheme. If we had to build it, it would have been a much different situation.
The never-ending debate about the costs of childcare, which for most parents is the second highest cost after the mortgage or the rent. That was Sinn Féin spokesperson for children Claire Curran, along with Fianna Fáil TD for Carlo Kilkenny, Peter Chap Clear, talking to Claire Byrne this morning. Anne's dog Rally leads a charmed life, as she explained to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline.
Did he jump off the cliff or did he fall off the cliff?
Well, we didn't actually see it, so we are pretty sure that he fell off the cliff because he's a little smarter than that, we like to think, that he would jump. But and his ball was actually up on the top of the cliff, too, so he wouldn't have jumped after that because he carries that everywhere he goes.
So you were out walking. We're talking about the cliffs in Howth, which in places at the Ben of Howth, for example, can reach over 500 feet. But anyway, you're out walking. And you have them under supervision, and then Rally, or Roddy, as he spelled.
Yes.
Rally, what happened, Rally?
Well, we are not 100% sure. We got around the bend, and he was a little bit ahead of us, and we started looking for him. We have two dogs, so our Border Collie was there.
Okay.
Her name's Sugar, and Rally had was gone. And there was a couple there who said... Well, we asked them if they had seen a little white dog, and they said, yes, he's fell over the cliff.
Ah.
So we, you know, obviously started to panic and had a fright. So we, you know, laid down on our bellies to try and find, you know, see if we could see him. We couldn't see him. We were yelling and hoping he would, you know, poke out, and he didn't. So I, you know, after a couple of minutes, you know, trying to call for him, I ran up to get the phone number for the Garda, and I called the Garda. And while my partner was, you know, staying there and laying on the cliff trying to get him to move so that we could see him. And so we got back. I ran back to the cliff, and, you know, we still hadn't seen anything or you know.
You haven't heard it. Did you hear barking or yelping or anything? No sound.
Nothing. It was just silent except for us yelling.
So you thought it was, bye-bye, Rally, bye-bye.
Oh, absolutely. We were sure. Well, we weren't sure, but, I mean, of course, we were hopeful still at that time. And so... my partner looked up and she saw four kayakers coming from the north.
Okay.
And they were quite a ways out. And we just started jumping and yelling. And at first they just waved back thinking we were just, you know, waving to them to say good morning. And and we finally just, you know, flagged them down and asked them to come in. And we yelled, hey, do you see a little dog on the beach there? And so they came up, you know, got closer, and one of the gentlemen said, yes, I see him. And we said, is he moving? And he said, no, at first. And then he said, oh, no, wait, he is. So we knew he was alive at that moment. So that
and are you shouting, Rally, Rally? Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. Trying to get him, you know, to, I don't know, look up. It was...
Yeah.
So we couldn't really see straight down the cliff. There was a little bit of a jut out there. So, you know, we were hoping he would kind of wander out, but he was not moving. So the kayaker jumped off his kayak and picked him up and carried him back to his kayak and put him between his legs and started paddling away.
Fantastic.
And he said, meet us at the Sutton Dinghy Club. And... So we said, okay, we will. So we jumped back in, we ran back up the hill and jumped in our car and went to the Dingy Club. And just as we were getting to the club, we could see the kayakers kayaking up to the club.
Now, when just to go back, paddle back. When these four, as you say, the four kayakers, they were all male. It was Sunday morning, March the 9th last. Out and out. We're trying to find them, obviously, to tell them how Rally is. But when they picked up Rally, and fair play to him, one of them got out of his kayak and waded in and got the dog. Had you any indication that Rally was still alive?
Oh, yeah. Well, he had said he was alive, and he said, and he also yelled out, and he said, he's got blood on him. He's going to need a vet. So that made us feel a little bit better, at least that he was alive. And Joe, just one thing. I think there may have been two men and two women. I don't remember that part clearly.
Okay.
So just to make sure.
Yeah. They said go to Sutton Sailing Club.
Yeah, the Sutton Dinghy Club.
Okay, and dinghies are different, obviously, to sailboats. But anyway, there is a Sutton Dinghy Club. By the way, how far do you think Rally fell? Rally dropped?
We think it was about 15 metres at that spot.
Okay. But would he have hit rocks in between or outcrops?
We think he would have hit an outcrop of on the wall, on the cliff.
So you now dash to Sutton Dinghy Club.
Yeah.
And the four musketeers, three musketeers plus an extra one, the four good Samaritans, the four rescuers, the four kayakers of the apocalypse, they come in to Sutton Dinghy Club. And what state was Rally in?
He was awake, but obviously in shock. He was very quiet and wasn't moving. But he was, awake and alert and looking at us.
And was he shaking?
No, he was just very still.
Okay. Do you think, you love him, obviously, and your other dog.
Very much, yes.
But did he show any contrition in his gorgeous little puppy eyes?
Did he say,
I'm sorry, mammy?
I think that he was more relieved to see us than anything. It was some relief, I think.
That's Anne telling Joe about the reckless adventures of her dog Rally on this afternoon's Liveline. Siblings Kat and Mick Ledden, both medics, run a charity called PsyCare, which aims to help people who run into drug-related difficulties at music festivals. Kat and Mick joined Oliver Callan this morning to talk about what it is they do as festival season nears.
Mick, we know loads of people go to all of these and love them, and it's a fun experience, but for a handful of people it's a disaster really, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately for a small minority that can be incredibly stressful spaces with the crowds, with the loud music, with overstimulation. Things also happen there, like assaults or fights with friends, but they're also really synonymous with really high levels of recreational drug and alcohol use. So we know for a fact large volumes of alcohol are consumed at these music festivals, but for another cohort they'll also perhaps choose to indulge in certain substance use, and when people do that we know for sure that they're vulnerable.
So obviously the alcohol is legal in festivals, drugs are illegal everywhere, and people, there's no safe way really to take them, is there? But unfortunately there's this enormous social acceptance among almost every demographic now, but in festivals you're out of any kind of area where you can, you're intense and so on, and surrounded by other people who are drunk and so on. So it's a difficult environment, isn't it?
Exactly. And things like, we know that festivals are risk-taking environments where people might be staying up for 2 or 3 days. There's dance music typically on until 3, 4, 5 in the morning at all of these events. So a lot of people may be disinhibited, may try drugs or substances for the first time, may take more than they usually would. And that's often where they get into trouble.
So what does PsyCare do? What is it exactly, this charity?
So yeah, Sidecar Ireland, we're a peer-led, volunteer-based organisation. Mm-hmm. So we set up safe spaces, welfare tents at these music events, where anyone who's having a mental health difficulty, a crisis induced by substances, or any kind of difficulty can come and be supported by a member of our team. So we're open 24 hours a day. We have about 180 volunteers, and to date, we've done 17 events and had 624 people through the door. So we typically see at least 1%, if not more, at other kinds of events end up in some kind of mental distress and with Sidecar.
That's surprisingly high, isn't it? That's a lot of people who need it.
It kind of is when you think 1% isn't very much. But actually, if you think about the Electric Picnic, 76,000 people, that's 760 people right there. So never mind all the other festivals happening. And this also can happen. You see people even at concerts around the place, you know, maybe they're having panic attacks or intoxicated. And up until now, there really hasn't been anywhere for people to go and to get support.
Mm-hmm. People will have heard of the drug testing at festivals, but this is not what you're doing, Kat.
Exactly, yeah. So the HSE, drugs.ie, the National Office of Social Inclusion, have previously performed drug checking at music festivals. So people can give in a sample and then receive a generalised result. They don't get their individual result back. Unfortunately, that isn't what we do. What we do is actually quite different. We provide a safe space. Mm-hmm. So the HSE have a number of volunteers who are trained in outreach, which is really excellent. But up until now, apart from Sidecar Ireland and a couple of other small operations, there are no safe spaces, you know. So many festivals we go to, there's nowhere even to sit down for a few minutes to rest your bones if you're tired, you know, and that's at the mild end of things. Those kind of stressors can build up, and sometimes people can need to be with us in a tent for sometimes several hours, you know, and it can go into the next day sometimes at the camping festivals, you know, so they're really important spaces.
The advice officially then from the likes of the HSE, obviously don't do drugs, but there's a health approach these days, isn't there, the realisation that people will do it anyway. What is the official advice at the minute?
Sure. So the first advice, I suppose, is as we've said, you know, the only safe way to take substances is not to do so. However, we acknowledge that people do. So when you meet people where they're at, you can then move from that place and offer proper advice that can help to reduce the harm. And that's what we're all about. So the first thing would be to start low and go slow. So if you are taking any kind of substance, like let's say an ecstasy pill, for example, instead of taking the whole lot in one go, break it up into smaller pieces. These days, MDMA pills are extremely potent. We know that from drug checking in Ireland and in Europe.
Yeah.
So breaking it up into quarters, for example. So that's start low and go slow. And making sure that you know that, you know, that you feel like the effect has come on before you take another dose. Don't take two doses at once, for example. And that would apply for powders as well, taking a very small amount of powder, waiting a period of time and then taking before you take any more. And then another piece of advice would be to avoid mixing substances. Now, this is really important because in Ireland, many people choose to drink alcohol, which is also a substance. And isn't a lot of recognition about that. Mm-hmm. But that actually complicates nearly all of the presentations that we see in Sidecar, you know. So someone might come in, for example, and they might have taken ketamine. But more often than not, it's not just ketamine. It might be alcohol and ketamine, which can be quite dangerous in combination.
So they could be drunk and then they're giving ketamine a go.
Yes.
Are you finding the people, the youngsters, particularly you're meeting at festivals, do they understand what the drug is going to do before they take it? Do they have a knowledge of
Particularly at some of the events we work at, we're kind of a younger demographic. And, you know, in one way, it's great to see dance music is becoming even more popular in Ireland these days. There's so many one day festivals popping up. But when we're in those spaces, what we often encounter is young people. They'll come in and say, oh, I just took, you know, some powder, or I just dipped my finger in the bag, and they had no idea about how much they were taking. Of course, they don't know anyway if what they got is the real thing that they thought it is, or whether it's adulterated, or whether how strong the dose is. But generally, we do kind of see that kind of, and especially again when people are intoxicated with alcohol, it becomes a kind of, oh, one more won't hurt, or, you know, I took some trips, a lot of people might say. And it's like, well, what's trips? Oh, some paper, you know, they're taking maybe LSD or mixing all kinds of things, or thinking
very strong hallucinogenic.
Absolutely.
Experience and on top of drink.
We see a lot of polydrug use, actually, you know, where we might see, you know, alcohol, cocaine, ketamine, MDMA. If someone is taking,
is it just in one, like
in one person?
Really,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And if you think about that from a physiological point of view, it's quite dangerous, but also from a psychological point of view, that someone, maybe that person could have difficulties in their life or trauma, and those things can get activated very strongly in those spaces.
I see what you mean.
So yeah, that's kind of why it's so important to have mental health support at these music festivals, where, you know, a lot of the promoters and a lot of the people, the Gardaí, they know that despite maybe their best efforts, a lot of substances are getting in irregardless, and they know people are consuming them on site. So, yeah, it really is kind of incumbent on them to see the need for mental health support in these spaces.
When someone's in trouble, do they tend to, is it friends that bring them along, or do they go on their own, or what sort of cases are you seeing?
It really depends. A lot of the time people are brought in by friends, but they could walk in themselves. We have people brought in by the guards, people brought in by security, by event staff. So it really depends on the presentation, really.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's Kat Ledden, along with her brother Mick, talking to Oliver Callan this morning about their charity PsyCare, which is aiming to give festival goers somewhere to go should they need help. Back on the Today programme, and Donacha O'Bachan, Professor of Politics at Dublin City University, and author of Unfinished Empire, Russian Imperialism in Ukraine and the Near Abroad, joined Claire Byrne this morning to talk about, well, Russia and Ukraine.
What do you think is behind the escalation in the aerial attacks on Ukraine in the last couple of days? What do you think is happening?
Well, this is all about messaging. You know, it's no coincidence that you have this spike 3 years and 3 months into the war, because there's unprecedented pressure on the Kremlin to negotiate, to move towards peace, to move towards a ceasefire. That's certainly the impetus that Donald Trump is trying to initiate. And indeed, as you say, has shown increased signs of frustration that it's not coming to fruition. So what Putin is trying to say is that, look, we have the momentum, the Ukrainians are exhausted, and therefore, if there is to be talks, and I don't believe these talks personally are going anywhere, but if there are to be any kind of talks, that we want to get the maximum, because, you know, we are exhausting the Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. They're on the back foot, and the any settlement should reflect that.
And how do you think Putin views Donald Trump?
I think he is, you know, impressed by the fact that they now have a US president who largely sings from the same hymn sheet. You know, the Donald Trump looks at the world in a way rather similar to Donald Trump. I mean, he looks at it in an almost Darwinian way, that the strong should prevail, the strong should dominate. I mean, you look at the way that Donald Trump has, you know, been in engaging with Canada, with Mexico, with Denmark over Greenland, indeed with the European Union. He's much more at home with dictators. I mean, look at his recent visit to the Middle East. He was very much at home with the leaders of Saudi Arabia, for example, United Arab Emirates. So, you know, from Vladimir Putin's perspective, this is the best US president he's ever going to get. And Donald Trump's big threat is that if there isn't an agreement between Russia and Ukraine, that he will walk away. Sure, that's what the Russians want. They'd love if America walked away from the conflict. So there's it's all carrot, really, mm-hmm. for Vladimir Putin and no stick. And yeah, that's why it's very difficult for Ukraine right now.
And it has been interesting to hear Donald Trump be somewhat more critical of Vladimir Putin in recent weeks. But he almost immediately follows those comments with criticism of President Zelensky of Ukraine.
Yeah, and unlike that kind of ill-concealed admiration he has for Vladimir Putin, there's also an obvious dislike towards Vladimir Zelensky.
Contempt, you know, saying every utterance from that man's mouth makes things worse.
Yes, I wish he would shut up. That's what he was saying. And the comment about, you know, Vladimir Putin, he says, I've always had a good relationship with him, and I don't know what's happened recently. You almost wonder, where has he been? You know, this escalation is nothing new. The time to be critical of Vladimir Putin was three and a half years ago, but there was nothing then from Donald Trump.
Listen, I have your book in my hand. It's called Unfinished Empire, as I say, and it does deal with the invasion of Ukraine, of course, but it goes back to Russia long before Vladimir Putin. He's just the latest line of rulers with expansionist ambitions. This is really nothing new, what we're seeing now.
That's right. I mean, what's happening in Ukraine and what's happening now is simply the latest manifestation of a very old story. And the book, you know, begins really in the 14th, 15th century with the Duchy of Moscow. And it demonstrates how the Russian Empire starts with very humble origins. It's an entity that is about the size of Albania today, so much smaller than Ireland. And it expands at a rapid pace, about 80 square kilometers every day for centuries, mm-hmm. until you get the current Russian Federation, which goes from the Baltic Sea to the Pacific Ocean. And a lot of that is because, of course, the peoples that they meet, the East in particular, are in Siberia. They're not as technologically advanced when it comes to weaponry. So they're exploited. They're essentially emasculated and incorporated into Russia. And Russia is a land empire. This makes it very different from, for example, the British Empire, which we're very familiar with. You'll remember, you know, the decolonization process that Britain engaged in. You know, when they gave up places like Ghana or Egypt or even in India, the jewel of the crown, there wasn't a huge psychological loss for Britain, because these nations had never been part of the House of Commons. They hadn't been part of the British system, and they disengaged incrementally and by design. Whereas the Russian Empire, in its latest manifestation, which was, of course, during Soviet times, collapsed unexpectedly. It wasn't a managed change, and it caused maximum humiliation. And a lot of these territories, because they were acquired as part of a centralized whole, they were much more difficult to say goodbye to. And in that way, you know, we would be surprised to find any ardent British imperialist today who'd say they should get India back or they should get Nigeria back. It's very mainstream in Russia to talk about their neighbours as areas that are destined to come back into the Russian fold.
Because of that, because they are land neighbours and because of the language as well, of course.
That's it. I mean,
cases.
It wasn't only about colonising territory, it was also about colonising the mind. And the Russification process was very, very strong. And again, we're familiar with that in Ireland, with the Anglicisation process. I mean, we've lost our language over the course of two centuries. Sometimes it happened over the course of two or three generations. I mean, I lived in Kazakhstan, for example, for 5 years. And there, you know, whereas Kazakh isn't as weak as the Irish language, but Russian is still the dominant language. And that occurred over a very short space of time because it was pushed through the education system. All the incentives were to learn Russian. And of course, there was a bit of a stick involved as well. So within most of Russia's neighbours, you have that linguistic divide. And what Russia has tried to do in recent times is to conflate Russian speaker with ethnic Russian and say we have a right to be interested in the fate of every country which has a lot of Russian speakers, which would be by comparison as if England would say that, well, Ireland is an English-speaking country, so is Canada, so is Australia, so we have a natural right to dominate those countries because they're full of people who are just like us. But of course, language doesn't determine identity.
Yeah, I suppose, as you said earlier, it's easier to make those arguments and make those claims when they're accepted in the mainstream. You know, it would be an anathema to make those claims here about the English language world as you've just outlined. But there it's accepted, isn't it?
It is. It's mainstream. It's on Russian state television all the time. I mean, Ukrainians are considered to be, for example, a fake nation, an artificial nation, kind of a political Frankenstein, which has been, you know, created by the West as a battering ram against Russia. And up until relatively recent times, Ukrainians weren't even called Ukrainians. They were called Little Russians. Mm-hmm. Belarusians were called White Russians, you know, so they don't consider them to be separate, and they're therefore kind of advocating some kind of national lobotomy, whereby they will no longer be victims of false consciousness. They will come back to their Russian roots, and then everything will be fine. And of course, because the Ukrainians didn't play their part in this narrative, they want to be independent. They have their own nation state. They want to be part of the European Union. Indeed, they're accepted as candidate members. This is why we have the war. It's to stop this, you know, departure. It's kind of decolonization remorse. They don't want, as I said, a Ukraine that's independent, prosperous, democratic part of the EU, not least because that would send a very important message to Russian people themselves. They would say, look at that. Why can't we have more of that? Why are we destined to have the same guy for a quarter century?
Yes.
And who's obviously going to leave the Kremlin horizontally because he has shown no inclination of leaving power.
Now, there's an image many might like to see. Donika O'Bakon, a professor of politics at DCU, talking Russia, the US and Ukraine with Claire Byrne this morning. Donika's book, Unfinished Empire, Russian Imperialism in Ukraine and the Near Abroad, is published by Agenda Publishing. The comedy institution that is Paul Whitehouse spoke to Ray Darcy this afternoon about his involvement in Only Fools and Horses, the musical, which is winging its way to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre next month.
So listen, you're more than acting in this because you're responsible for getting it to the stage.
Well, I mean, to an extent, but it's a very collaborative process.
Yeah.
But it was weirdly, it was John Sullivan's last project to do a musical version of Only Fools and Horses. And you'd think, oh dear, really? But because it was John Sullivan's, the original creator and writer, you know, it was his wish. And very sadly, he died, you know, before he'd really had any chance to do much with it. I think he'd written one song with Chaz Hodges, Chaz and Dave, and his son took up the kind of cudgel and asked me would I be involved. And at first I was a bit wary, you know, because he's such an institution. And, you know, I didn't want to be the one that mucked it up and destroyed people's treasured memories of this, you know, as you put it.
Like British institution.
Yeah, I know. So it was very slow process. And we gradually did some little workshops and wrote a couple of songs, and other people, you know, made my sort of rather stumbling chord changes a bit slicker, yeah. and gradually piece it together. And then we thought, yeah, well, I think this could work, you know. And Jim Sullivan, who was John's son, is a very accomplished writer in his own right. And he obviously knows the show inside out. And it was very important for me to have the kind of backing of the family. You know, I didn't want to do it if there was going to be any battles there at all, or they weren't happy with how it was proceeding. So Jim was crucial, really. And then, you know, there was a bit of trepidation when we started, you know, because I know people come to it and go, all right, go on then. Go on then, White House. Yeah. See if you're
make
any
us
good,
laugh,
really.
Make us,
yeah. But we knew, we were confident, we were very, you know, we stuck very faithfully to the kind of ethos of Only Fools. And we, you know, we try and get all the top gags in, or at least we reference them. We've got all the main characters, and we've got some good songs, actually. You know? And weirdly, there's so many gags in it, and there's so many strong characters. It's actually quite nice to have a little break every few minutes and have a song, you know?
Yeah. And Paul, is music your first love? Is that the lyrics from a song?
Yeah.
Music was my
it
first
is, really,
love.
It is, really, right? Yeah. I know it was, wasn't it? Who was that?
Music was my first love.
Oh, God, John. Oh, blimey, I forgot his name.
Yeah.
Music was my first love. I know it didn't sound like it when I burst into song there, but
so it was. Were you in a band as a kid, or were?
Oh yeah, I was in some terrible bands. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
One or two reasonable ones, but mainly bad. Yeah. I actually auditioned for a band. Called that petrol emotion.
Oh yes, brilliant band.
They were sort of
Irish.
Yeah, they were. They were kind of the what was left of the Undertones after Fergal left.
Yeah,
and they reformed and went on to be great with a really good singer instead of me.
And they had a hit. I used to play. I can't remember the name of it now, but. They'd one hit, as in it got into the UK top 20 or whatever.
Yeah.
And did you auditioned to be the lead singer? Did you?
Yeah, but I mean, right. My head wasn't. Let's say my head wasn't in the right space at the time.
so then, how did you meet up with Harry Enfield? And you know, so did he encourage you to write and to perform, or what happened?
Yeah, he did. Right, really. We were friends. You know, we had sort of mutual friends, and I was going to say they were Irish, so they were, but I don't. So they just said,
no, that's fine, it's fine. No, it doesn't.
Right?
Sorry. No, if you say to me, I love you, Irish, I love your Guinness, then that's corny. Factual stuff isn't corny, Paul. You can do with the factual stuff.
Okay. No, is it okay to say I don't like Guinness?
Yeah,
no, see, now you've just opened a pitfall, really, for me, haven't you? And I jumped right in it. Harry was a friend of a friend, and so we sort of gradually came together. And I used to just sort of muck about in the pub and whatever, and Harry sort of persuaded me, coerced me into doing some writing and performing. And we're, you know, he had a great platform, Harry, for those early characters of like Stavros and Loads of Money, because we had a program over here, Friday Night Live, Saturday Night Live, and it was, you know, there were only four channels. And so when Harry came on and did those characters, they sort of landed immediately. And that was a mix of comedy and music, that show, you know, hosted by Ben Elton.
Yeah.
And it sort of established Harry almost, I say, overnight. He'd been gigging for years, you know. But that was his sort of first major TV comedy platform. And it was a perfect vehicle for those characters, and that's where we then were able to sort of write couple of sketch show series for Harry, and then the Fast Show, and it developed from there, really. So, yeah.
Was it great crack, or was it relentless having to produce that stuff?
Well, you know, it's like anything like that, any sort of creative thing. Yes, it's great. I mean, you can't, you know, it's such a privilege and a joy to do it.
Yeah.
But like any of those, there are always tensions and there are always differences of opinion. And so, you know, it's the... And you have to, you know, you live it and breathe it 100%. So, you know, it's like anything. And there are good bits and bad bits. But most of the time, it's, very lucky. It's a joy. And same with this, you know, these aren't characters that I've come up with, obviously. But they're a privilege to do. And yeah. So, you know, I get to do Grandad, and I get to do a little cameo as Uncle Albert at the end of the show. And... I mean, mainly my beard does and all the acting. And I just wiggle that beard around and I milk it for all it's worth.
Comedian Paul Whitehouse talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. Only Fools and Horses, the musical, runs at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre from the 30th of June. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, Oliver Callan spoke this morning to Ireland's youngest ever Olympic sailor, Eve McMahon, who's back home after making history by winning bronze at the World Sailing Championships in China.
This is historic for Ireland, isn't it? Explain to us why.
It is such an amazing medal. It's a really special medal. It's the first time ever an Irish female sailor has won a world medal. So to come home, back home, and I had an amazing welcome at the airport as well with all my friends and my family, and my feet haven't quite hit the ground, but to be able to bring home a world bronze medal for the first time for Ireland for Irish sailing, it's something I'm hugely proud of.
Ah, we're delighted for you. Did you expect to win?
To be honest, I put in so much hard work. A lot of the girls, a lot of the other competitors, they're such highly experienced sailors, and I knew it would definitely be tough work.
Yeah.
The competition was such tight points, so there was a lot of girls in it for medals, but to be able to kind of come away with it, with all the results coming together and, you know, all the hard work that I've put into it, like I said, it's something that I'm hugely proud of, and it's nice to see all the hard work paying off, because sometimes high performance sport can be quite cutthroat, so it's nice to have one of the highs.
Especially getting a medal so young in the game as well. The boat that you're sailing is the ILCA-6. Can you explain that to the rest of us who don't understand sailing?
Yeah, so the ILCA-6, it's the single-handed Olympic women's dinghy class. So that's the boat that we sail at the Olympic Games. And that's just one person in the boat. So it's just myself, my sail, and I have full control of everything. And then we sail, our races are about 50 minutes long, and we sail around buoys.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the least points is the better in our competition. And the amount of competitors, we have a huge amount of competitors in that World Championships that I just won bronze at. There is 99 other competitors, so it's a huge fleet of boats. So consistency is definitely key.
What kind of skills does a sailing champion need at the level that you're competing at?
For me, I would definitely say, just with all the learnings that I've had, you definitely need a lot of resilience, just because there's so much out of your control, because you are dealing with Mother Nature. You're out there with the wind, the waves, the movement of the water, everything. There's so many things. And obviously when you've 99 boats, you don't know what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to really kind of understand some things might not go my way. I might have the best week of my life, but there is a little bit of luck involved, but I'm a strong believer of you make your own luck. But you definitely have to have a huge amount of resilience. You just have to keep kind of pushing and working at it and understanding that there's definitely going to be highs and lows. But when you are dealing with Mother Nature, you can't control everything. So definitely being able to control the controllables.
And it's a sport you have to get into at an early age. What age were you when you began sailing?
So I'm quite lucky that I have two older brothers who were really into sailing as well. My oldest brother was actually competing with me in China, which is quite special.
Really?
Not something that all the other competitors have, to have a sibling there with them.
Mm-hmm.
So my oldest brother just started in Hoth Yacht Club, which would be my home club. So that's where I kind of grew up sailing. And my parents kind of got us into sailing just in summer courses in Hoth Yacht Club. And I would have been about 6 or 7 years old starting off. Ah. So I kind of, you know, just completely did it for fun. And I was doing other sports as well. And I just really took to sailing. I just honestly loved the freedom of everything. It's you go out in the water, you're with nature. It's just complete tranquility is kind of the word I'd use to describe it. And I just absolutely loved it. And I just started doing little competitions, followed in the footsteps of my two older brothers, and kind of took off from there.
It doesn't look very tranquil when you see the speeds that you're doing.
Yeah. And there's definitely some points where it comes to chaos in the race course and everything. But that's also what I love. There's two different sides to sailing. You know, there's the real high performance side of it, but then there's just also the really nice side of it where you're just able to kind of take a break from, you know, the world, I suppose, just being out in the water.
Men and women compete separately in sailing. Are there differences in the boat or in what you have to do?
Yeah, correct. So in the class of boat that I sail, my oldest brother, he would sail the Ilka 7 and I would sail the Ilka 6. And the only difference is their sail size is slightly bigger than us. So it's a little bit more powerful, but the fundamentals of it is all the same. And that's why I think it's really nice to have them there, because the fundamentals are the same and the principles are the same. You know, we're able to bounce ideas off each other. And we're able to debrief together and watch videos together. And if he's struggling on something or if I'm struggling on something, you know, we're able just to kind of come together as a family and go, okay, how can I improve on this? Or what am I not seeing that you might be able to see? And that's why I think it's such a lovely boat to sail, because you're able to relate to somebody so easily.
You see, you're so modest, even when I was calling it the ILCA. ILCA 6 is what I'm supposed to be saying.
ILCA, It was formerly called the Laser Radial, which would have been the same boat that Annalise Murphy won a silver medal.
That's right,
in
the
Rio,
lasers
so.
We've heard of, yeah.
Correct, yes.
ILCA 6. Well, we know it now. Thanks for the correction. This must have brought you all over the world, has it, Eve?
It has brought me, to every corner of the world, to be honest with you. I was so lucky enough that just before the Tokyo Olympic Games, I was actually training alongside Annalise Murphy, and we had the World Championships, which was the last World Championships before the Tokyo Olympic Games, and that was in Australia. So I got to kind of pack up my stuff for 3 months and go out with her and just be able to experience the senior fleet. You know, it was right before the Olympic Games, so everybody was really hyped up and everyone was trying to get their last bit of preparation. But to be sailing in Australia at 15 years of age, it's, you know, it's pretty insane.
Oh,
and then I qualified Ireland for the Paris 2024 Olympic Games in Argentina, so at the World Championships in Argentina. So there's loads of places, and I'm actually fortunate enough that in July I'm heading off to Los Angeles, which is obviously where the 2028 Olympic Games are going to be, and that's going to be the kind of the start of getting used to the Olympic waters in Los Angeles. So
that's
excited about that. So like you say, it's such an international sport.
The impressive Eve McMahon, Ireland's youngest ever Olympic sailor, talking to Oliver Callan this morning, having brought home bronze in the World Sailing Championships. And that's all I have for you on this dull Tuesday in May edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on the air and in podcast land every Saturday with an altogether less grey, less wet, less cold look back at an entire week in radio. But for me, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck. Mon visage.